What does that say about the main course that the producer and engineer keep picking that song as our intro?
I think we're supposed to have a theme, Patrick. We're supposed to be recognizable instantly from the moment we start to broadcast.
Am I supposed to be twirling a cane on my finger and wear a little black hat?
Yeah, right. And be waxing your mustaches with the other hand.
And go through all the clocks and modern times.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Well, it's the main course today.
On that's Heritage another... Radio Network. And we're sponsored today by...
White Oak Pastures Beef, our newest sponsor.
Our newest from Atlanta. Sponsor. That's fantastic. Congratulations to the fundraising team.
Yes. He's 100% grass-fed and actually has opened his slaughterhouse on his land. So it's a zero environmental footprint process.
How did he get USDA certification for that? Aren't they kind of picky about that stuff?
Not in the South.
Oh.
He had his home of Tyson.
Why am I even asking?
He's also president of the Georgia Organics Group, which is like the number one organic coalition in the country. I mean, of all the state organic groups, like the Georgia Organics Conference, this year they have Michael Pollan speak. I was lucky enough to be there, and he's the chairman of the board. So I just think he's like a big influential figure, and he's fourth generation beef producer, too.
Can we get him on the show sometime?
He was actually on the show...
Before I arrived.
Yeah, he was a very interesting southern drawl, like very deep voice. I can't even do it. But do we have a deep voice sound effect?
I don't think so. But, well, that sounds really exciting. I think we should have him back now that I know about him. You know how much I love to talk about beef.
Yes, you're a butcher.
I was a butcher.
Jeez, that's so amazing.
I love talking about meat, man.
We're at Roberta's, of course, at 261 Moore Street, a great restaurant. And yesterday, all during the day, the Yaks played, the Wild Yaks.
Oh, I'm so sorry I missed that. That must have been a really good time.
Well, that's Chris Paracchini's brother, Chris, the owner of Roberta's. And it is very, very cool band. I mean, they could be big one day. I mean, they already are big.
And you can say you knew them way back when.
I remember when they played on top of the radio studio.
Shades of the Beatles.
So did you eat anything to speak of this week?
Oh, my God. Well, the best thing that happened to me this week was I spent a few days up in Rhode Island. And one of my buddies up there directed me to a brand new restaurant that opened on July 1st called the Matunic Oyster Bar. It's run by a guy named Perry Rosso. And next week, I hope to bring to you a little 10-minute interview that I did with him.
Can we hear this in it?
You might hear a seagull. Yeah, you'll definitely hear that.
Awesome.
Because he's right near Galilee. So he is an oyster farmer, and he raises little oysters in Matunic, which he calls Matunics. He farms them in Potter's Pond, which is a tidal pond in the Matunic area. And he's in part of a cooperative with about six other oyster farmers, and they're raising some really nice oysters in that southern Rhode Island coastal area, which used to be, for years, generations, was a tremendous shellfishing location, but over I guess it was in the 50s and 60s, like many other riverfront or oceanfront populations, the fish were polluted out, and it's taken a long time to take that water back, but they have it, and the oysters were phenomenal.
What are their names?
There's the Matunics, I think succotash, Potters. Mm-hmm. They were mostly Charlestown. They were mostly tied to the locations along the coast that they're being farmed in. But
don't oysters, like, one of their functions is to actually clean?
Absolutely.
So they were just being overwhelmed.
Their feeder, they were overwhelmed. And the water, the water, they've had to roll back some of that pollution, some of the dumping that was going on. Of course, Rhode Island, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but Rhode Island has traditionally had its share of shifty types in government and who were, awarding contracts and then sort of turning a blind eye to inappropriate practices, shall we say. Yes. Lots of those. And so so there was a lot of stuff going on that it took many, about a generation really to clean up. I remember when the effort to clean up the Rhode Island waterways started back in the late 60s, early 70s with a guy named Frosty Drew. So,
but I mean, just corrupt politicians don't necessarily imply ignoring waterways and...
Well, it implies to me, and certainly the upshot...
Stuff
of their,
not getting done.
Yeah, stuff was not getting done, or rather, they were awarding contracts to, unscrupulous types who would then dump toxic waste into water, which is what was happening.
Which is actually part of that movie, Scarmozza, what was it?
I don't know.
Scorroza. It was who did Goodfellas and all that. Famous director from NYU.
Oh, you're asking the wrong
What's
girl.
That? Scorsese. Martin Scorsese. His latest movie about the Naples streets.
Oh, yeah.
They had some guy who like dumped just oil.
Well, like, that's a huge problem now in Italy. You know that, right?
Yeah.
Have you read those stories in the papers about,
pretty crazy.
You know, some really nasty stuff being buried all over the place and nobody will ever find it until, you know, they develop some interesting cancer.
Crazy. Exactly. James Dyson, maybe he should invent like a house cleaning thing that's based off of the oyster. Just leave like an oyster type thing in the middle of your living room and over time, like things.
I think
just
it's called Roomba.
Roomba.
I own stock in that company, so please buy it.
Okay, yeah. Count me in. Can we do barter? Pizza yeah, for right. shares?
Exactly.
So
it's about what it's worth now.
We have a very interesting guest coming up. And
we do.
Now the intro is officially over, and we are transitioning into the main course.
Oh, okay, cool.
Appetizers are done.
Appetizers are done.
They were good.
Let's
some amuse bouche.
Let's bring our man in now, since he's sitting right here. We have James Curry with us.
Being very silent.
Talk about radio silence.
I was trying to be polite.
Yeah, you're doing a great job, James. James is the executive editor of Epicurious.com.
James Oliver Curry, right?
James Oliver Curry, I should say that. I know, you do go by the James Oliver, don't you?
I can describe that another time. It was a necessity when I first started out in journalism.
Oh, really? Because there was another? Because there's Jason Oliver Nixon.
I was afraid James Curry would get lost in the shuffle, and I knew the Oliver gave it a little oomph, a little bit of pretension, but yeah. Just enough that, you know, I thought it might even lend me some credibility.
And you were a jock in high school, so JOC are now your...
I was so not a jock. That was part of the irony of that particular, those initials.
Anyway, James, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really great to have you on. James and I met over the phone when I was doing publicity, probably for, I don't know who, Food Network, Anthony Bourdain, one of those guys. And you were the food editor for Time Out magazine, right?
Time Out New York, yes.
Time Out New York, yeah, yeah. And then about 3 years ago, you made the jump to Epicurious.
That's exactly
Let's
right.
Let's talk a little bit about the differences between those two publishing entities. You know, like you were saying earlier, the difference between the regional versus the national and the access and the, you know, the sort of general resource allocation that is so different between the two.
Well, I consider myself very lucky to be able to be involved in food journalism in any capacity. It came at the end of having already been a computer journalist and a music critic. Time Out New York is very regionally focused. It's just New York. There are Time Outs in other cities like Time Out Chicago and Time Out London. Notorious for having no money and for being really a place where young writers and editors start and then move on. And in fact, the food editors at Time Out New York have gone on to really illustrious careers. That's one department in particular where a lot of the better food writers and editors have spent some time. I could rattle
off
a list.
It's like where you log on hours, you know? Actually, ironically,
it's a farm. And you get to know everybody.
It's like a farm for talent, really.
One of my friends who's a writer said that actually... the porn industry is so big that it requires writers to produce, you know, to write 10 movies a week or something of total trash. But, you know, I mean, that's also it's ironic where people actually get trained.
I had never made the connection between pornography and Time Out New York.
Porn?
But yeah, now the connection
now they're very
established.
Related.
I really appreciate that. And I will forever after be able to link those two concepts.
And then my cousin came up with the concept of fear porn, which is pretty much what journalism is nowadays in terms of mainstream, you know, reporting the news. Yeah, absolutely. Fear porn. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a blog where sometimes we'll talk about E. coli and things like that, but we try to veer away from just being the sensationalist scaremonger.
Well, when I was looking, I was, I check out Epicurious pretty regularly, but when I was looking at it again this morning to make sure I wasn't missing any major feature, I was really amazed at the sort of, you know, it really is very recipe driven. It's very driven by, you know, the real, really actually cooking. And as we were coming out to the studio today, I actually missed my stop because I was reading so intently Michael Pollan's article in the Sunday Times magazine about the fact that we don't cook anymore. And I think that and that food has become a recreational sport of watching as opposed to actually doing. Or if you do cook, you cook on weekends only or only for special occasions. And I
was
thought,
that the point of his article?
Yeah. Hmm. And I thought it was great to see on your site that it's still absolutely rooted in the hands-on. You've got the videos, you've got the recipes, you've got all the different types of reasons to cook and so forth. So
I can speak to that in many ways, in particular bridging the other question that you had, which is how is Time Out different from Epicurious. And I don't think people would ever link the two together unless they happen to be talking to me, because right. Time Out New York not only is regional, whereas Epicurious is national, international. Time Out was largely print. Epicurious is online. Time Out always has been 14 years now.
They're the only. They were the beginning of the real concentrated food blog. Yeah,
it may be the first food site, or certainly the first recognizable food site that still has its own brand identity, even though it has been associated with and often confused with its sibling media empires of Gourmet and Bon Appetit. But to get to your point, fundamentally speaking, Time Out New York, I was the editor of a section called the Eat Out section, right. And we were not supposed to cover anything that regarded eating in. And Epicurious is almost mm-hmm. exclusively about eating in, except for a couple of stories that we will have about travel or restaurants. So that is another fundamental difference between the two. One is about eating out, the other is eating in, cooking. And for sure, the amount of traffic that comes to our site is just disproportionately and hugely and rightfully so all about the recipe databases that we have.
I had a couple of points. I mean, interesting, slow food was the first food movement to come around during email and internet. So, you know, it was able to disseminate its message. They always put in a lot of energy into their website and such. But very interesting that they went right to the web as a means to communicate their message. I mean,
no sooner was there computers? A web.
I mean, how has it changed its vision from when it started to today? I mean, did it know it would be a recipe-based site?
It certainly did. It was going to be the aggregator of all recipes from Condé Nast. So it does have recipes from Self and from cookbook authors and some originally developed and tested from Epicurious. So it's not just Gourmet and Bon Appetit recipes. I think the way it has developed and evolved over time has a lot to do with how technology has and the way people browse online now. We have gone through many significant redesigns where the idea is more people come in now through Google, for example, than ever before. And it used to be that you would hope they would know about Epicurious and bookmark it and go there. Well, you have to change your strategy. If people coming in, they're no longer using the front page that much. So you have to design your site so that no matter what recipe people find through a Google search or another search, Bing, Yahoo, you name it, that they can see what else is on your site, because you don't want them to come to the recipe and then leave. You want to show them all the other great things you have. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that has changed. One thing that has stayed the same but that we've built on that I think is interesting and might even hark to slow food movement and other trends is that we have always cultivated a sense of community. And in many ways, people talk about some of the first online communities being those people who came to Epicurious and left a review of a recipe, and then people would either comment on the review or comment on the recipe again, and you would really drive a lot of traffic with people talking about food on those recipes, if not in the forums elsewhere.
Well, I was fascinated this morning when I was reading it. One of your regular bloggers, I guess, Michael
Park,
had done a wonderful red carpet wrap-up on the premiere of Julie and Julia last night. I'm telling you, I laughed out loud all the way through it. It was really terrific. But what was really nice was how many people commented on Michael's entry and then said, well, why didn't you eat anything? And, you know, that's really...
He's brilliant. I mean, when we brought him terrific. On to be a blogger, we decided, this is another change that speaks to your question of how has it changed over the years. Before, 14 years ago, there was no blog. Eventually, there was a quasi-blog, which was Tanya Steele, our illustrious editor-in-chief, chiming in once a day with a little hello, and we called that the epilogue. And when I came on board, we realized that we had to have a more substantial daily content, that we couldn't just have a recipe database and maybe the occasional feature. So we decided that we were going to have this group blog. And in that, we tried to amass 5 to 10 really well-known people who could represent different categories that you might care about. One might be family man, or one might be the healthy gal, or one might be the political person.
Right.
And so we had Rick Bayless as the celebrity chef, and we had Neil Pollack, the author, and sort of satirist and funny man, writing about cooking with his kids. And so he was the cooking with dad. And Michael Park was the only one who wasn't really famous, and no one knew of him, but he's the only one who's really lasted. And it's because his writing is so good.
Yeah, it's excellent. It was very, very funny and very acute, I might add.
Then, this is also interesting. I mean, also one of the other things is I think this is such a part of a revolution. Like, I think in the 70s, I mean, how many great restaurants were there in New York? I know there were tons of coffee shops and definitely tons of diners, you know, but I think people ate at home a lot more. I mean, there weren't stands all throughout the streets serving, you know, small family farm hot dogs from upstate New York. I mean, good food has become a lot more accessible. So, you know, the blogs, Epicurious, Time Out. I mean, it's at the very nascent stage of food awareness. You know, we had taken it for granted. It got co-opted, and now we're just that first
generation.
We're
taking back the food industry is what I see it as. I mean, yeah. I think if more and more people get back into the kitchen, and I to paraphrase Dan Barber, who made this remark at a panel that I saw, it's like if and also to speak to Michael Pollan's piece today, it's like we can talk about sustainability, we can talk about locavorism, we can be all happy and you know delighted that we're growing our vegetables on the roof, but if nobody is in the kitchen, then this is irrelevant.
I don't know and about I think that. I think chefs are better cooks, and if it becomes more accessible and you can have an osteria in every neighborhood, you know, in Italy, people eat at home. Here in the States, I think that's how fast food has become successful. You know, I wouldn't try to change the formula. I would try to work with the existing one and make that more sustainable. Because if I lived here at Roberta's in this neighborhood where I do, kind of, I would eat here 3-4 times a week. I mean,
well,
I just
passed a couple that I met here the other night on Thursday night that I, you know, was sitting at the communal table and struck up a conversation with them. They were fabulous. And here they are again. This is clearly their neighborhood osteria. But I think, no, I disagree with you, Patrick. I think that people do need to spend more time in the kitchen. I think they do need to reconnect with the stuff that matters in terms of getting responsibly raised foods. And I don't think until you get more people actually participating in buying those foods, then you are not going to have a movement that goes beyond the, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% of the people who are already participating in it. And well, that's what I think is the challenge.
Restaurants can drive an industry too, you know, and I think if more people support more restaurants. But I just think about Denny Abrams, who's one of the investors in Heritage Foods. He also owns and designed all of 4th Street in Berkeley. He has not eaten at home since like 1981. And I'm like, at first I was like, well, how, what, you're missing? And in the end, I was like, that's fantastic. He goes to his favorite restaurants and lets professionals do it. You know, it's
I think
like
that's great if you have the disposable income for it. But personally speaking, that would not work for me. What about you, James?
Yeah, no, I can't afford to eat out all the time or even as much as I used to. Budgets have been cut, travel expenses. But it was never my money to begin with. But there is the big issue about how do we even define cooking today, which was something that Michael Pollan brought up in the New York Times Magazine article this Sunday, but also something I interviewed Nora Ephron, which was a story that's going to go up on Monday on Epicurious.com.
Uh-huh. Oh, cool.
And she also talks about how we think we're a culture that is much more involved in food and cooking because we watch TV shows that have chefs, but that in reality we are a culture that is watching people cook, not really cooking. And so that to me is an interesting topic. I don't think I could chime in about whether that means that I have to somehow get people to cook more, or if they cooked more, that if that would be better for society, because that's a thorny topic that the two of you seem to have already.
The way, I'm talking about in an ideal world of restaurants. I mean, as it exists now, I'm not recommending to go to Mama Fuko Sambar 4 days a week, but I'm saying like a hot dog, if cooked sustainably, costs $3. A slice of pizza done well could cost $3, you know, if they're using
and you couldn't buy that for yourself.
And, you
I mean,
know,
you couldn't
you
make it at home with
time?
That same
you
money.
You could,
yeah,
but,
exactly.
You know, not all people
well,
have
there's something
to cook.
Be said. No, not all people have to cook,
in
and not every
opinion.
Meal has to be made at home. I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that, especially in the more sort of recession-conscious times that we're in right now, that this is a good time for people to remember that cooking is really not rocket science and that it's really pretty easy. You can go on to an epicurious.com or equivalent site and find something to make. As long as you can read, you can cook. That's always been my philosophy about cooking. It's like there is no mystery to this. Read it, follow the directions, and with a little bit of practice, you too.
But I did not mean to be impolite. That you know,
as
no
good
one
as,
needs
you know,
about recipes not being important. In fact, one of my questions to you is: has the public, general public, lost a connection to recipes? I mean, do people? Would this site have been as necessary 50 years ago, even if there was a web?
The technology to support it?
That's a great question. And, I, you know, I don't know the demographics of who was cooking 50 years ago or even really who's cooking now. I know who is coming to Epicurious and that our traffic has grown from year to year. And I think that we certainly try to make it as easy as possible for people to make recipes as well. You know, there's a slightly gourmet angle and reputation for Epicurious, but we have quick and simple recipes, and We make it extremely easy for people to type in any keyword or mm-hmm. to exclude keywords.
You have fabulous shopping list technology. That really impressed me with the way you guys organize the shopping list.
It's hard for me to say, like, how would Epicurious have fared 50 years ago? Because the whole infrastructure and culture was so different. It's hard for me to imagine. You know, there was no internet. There were no computers. That people's time was different. I think one of the things that wasn't mentioned recently in that Pollen article that I think is true is that we just spend so much more time feeling like we're busy. And I guess they mentioned it a little bit, but
well, he did. He said we work the equivalent of an extra 2 weeks out of the year in this country as opposed to any other country on the planet.
Hmm. You know, I think if you come home at 7 or 8 o'clock, you're not going to be as likely to cook. And particularly if you have a family, than if you came home at 5 or 6. And I think that people also feel more oppressed by he did mention that people are much more concerned about their money and their time than they might have been a while back. And that cooking seems to be something that either costs money or that takes up time in a way that people had 50 years ago more. So in some ways...
Right. Well, I mean, I also think what's at the third place, they call the coffee house the third place. I mean, you know, the family unit isn't defined as, a father and a mother and 2.5 kids and the picket fence. So with new lifestyles and less of a, you have to be in a family... I think going out, having your local places, where you spend your time and maybe also not eating that much. You know, it's become more of a tapas. You eat a little bit, a light salad with your glass of wine by the subway, and then you go home, So.
The third place concept is a big one, too. You're right. Families are not eating together as much. So, I mean, are you going to cook for yourself or just your partner when you have 2 or 3 kids and they're eating on their own schedule? If we didn't have Starbucks on every corner 50 years ago, which is a place for everybody to go to grab a snack or have a coffee. So there are so many factors that could be considered either cause and effect or correlations, right, depending on how you look at it.
Well, we have to take a break, but this is very interesting. We are with James Oliver Curry, and we are going to drop this sound effect right now. Check this out.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Sweet! Okay, I think we're on. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're on the main course with Patrick Martins.
Hello.
And Katie Kiefer. And our guest today is James Oliver Curry, from epicurious.com. And we were having a riveting, at least to me, conversation about cooking in the home and recipes and how you... I wanted to ask you this, James, when we were talking earlier about who is your demographic? Who actually is downloading these recipes? And, you know, if you were to believe the article that Michael Pollan wrote today in the Times, it was, what was the statistic that he said about how, you know, fewer than, I don't know, one in five or something like that are actually cooking a meal at home or are making a meal that takes more than 26 minutes to make?
Yeah, you know,
the average time
I'd say
spent
that
100%
of those people, though, are coming to Epicurious, or at least the concept is that obviously if you're not cooking, you're not coming to Epicurious for the most part, unless you happen to hit one of our articles about the best burgers in America or something right. else through Google. But our demographics tend to be very consistent. It's at least 70% female and 30% male, mm-hmm. Which might be the exact inverse at, say, like an ESPN.com.
Right.
We are very aware of our demographics when it comes to, like, you know, average education, college educated, you know.
Income levels.
Income levels and, you know, a good amount of income. And beyond that, we can look at things like what countries or what cities they're coming from. We know that outside the United States, Canada actually does get a lot of traffic to us, which I found very interesting. And every time I try to write about, you know, recipes or trends or food events, I try to remember, well, what's going on in Canada, as if it's this little, you know, appendage to the United States when it's just a gigantic country. And mm-hmm. every time we do cover Canada, we get a lot of emails saying, thank you for covering Canada.
Well, I think they have a very vibrant food scene. I mean, at whatever. Least certainly in Quebec.
But you know, I think that one of the things that Michael Pollan was writing about, which I just love as a concept, is what is cooking. And he was talking about microwaving a pizza is not cooking, but somehow putting together a sandwich is, because there's assembly required, at least.
Right.
And sandwiches.
Well,
actually
you have to think about putting together ingredients in a sandwich.
Right. It's more than just heating it up, I guess. And you know,
and also percentages, how much lettuce to tomato to the meat to the bread.
Yeah, you're creating a recipe when you make a sandwich. Absolutely. Yeah. Whether it's peanut butter and jelly or a muffaletta. I mean, you know,
dough or your bread needs more of something, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I've written about sandwiches for a lot of different magazines. It's a subject I think I know a lot about.
Really? Tell us something.
Oh, good,
because
I
us some headlines.
I had a question about that.
You know, it's funny. I've written about sandwiches. Usually, here's another thing that the internet has driven, which is top 10 lists. And I think that these have existed in magazines forever. But nowadays, it's the formula for either driving traffic or for getting picked up on one of the social, you know, bookmarking sites. And so way back when I wrote about the best sandwiches in the United States for Maxim magazine. I was an editor at Playboy, which I don't think I mentioned to you when we were talking about Time Out and Epicurious.
Which is that sound effect that goes, yeah, I forget. That's awesome.
And
did you live in Chicago? Or in...
No, they have offices on 5th Avenue and 56th Street in Manhattan. And I did get a chance to go to the mansion once, but I never met me. And
did you meet the girls next door?
You know what? I think I met other members of the press. That's about it.
Is the mansion super clean? Like, with all those people, are there not as many people there as one would think? Like, is the pool clean?
I'll tell you the truth in my experience is that they have some parties that are inside and outside, and some that are just outside, sort of on the lawn. And I was one of the outside parties. So, even, you know, I was
you had like a green patch on you. You were like, outside. Yeah,
exactly. I had no access. So there's not a great story there, particularly about food, but it was
clean, right?
It was very clean. It was very well. It was manicured. He had a zoo there.
That's what I mean. There seems a lot going on there.
And
monkeys.
Shades of Michael Jackson.
I'm not using that euphemistically or metaphorically. He literally has, you know, he literally has animals roaming on the space
there.
Oh my God. But when I did join Playboy and was working on their website, I introduced food as a topic. It was the first time they had a regular coverage of food.
Okay.
And this was, I had to decide what topics I thought were relevant to men on a daily basis.
Right.
And I was not allowed to cover the sex. That was someone else's job. So mm-hmm. it was all lifestyle topics. And among the many things we covered were cars, gadgets, fashion, and food and drink. And that was actually, that was a precursor of my career at Time Out New York. But it was also, I think, indicative of the idea that this was around year 1999 to 2000 that food was becoming quite trendy, or at least was becoming entering the popular culture.
Well, that was the year that Anthony Bourdain's book was published, Kitchen Confidential, and that to me was the beginning of the star chef phenomenon.
So me and Anthony Bourdain really brought it on, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
It's just
the
two of us, single-handedly sparked the revolution.
How scary!
Sorry, I know you probably are responsible for it.
Well, actually, James, you
not
would
all.
Be
not
kind of
studies.
Responsible for it because you were working in a major national magazine, which is, and that magazines act as trendsetters, right? They don't just follow trends, they set trends.
And depending on which magazine you're talking about.
Yeah, and the internet. Something like Playboy, come on.
And the internet that creates a sense of place. I mean, like a site, that's what the Heritage Radio Network site is trying to be, like a place that after people go to. You know, people have to go there and visit a single, you know, right now we don't podcast, we want to eventually, but we want people coming to a site. I mean, how many subscribers do you have? Do you send out weekly email blasts? Like, what can one expect?
We do. We have something called a Recipe Flash. You can sign up to get feeds of lots of our different blogs. Our traffic generally, we look at it. I can give you page views. I can give you unique visitors. And this is all vocabulary that you have to learn in the web world that I certainly didn't know when I was in the print world.
Well, which ones is page views? That's how many pages someone goes through on the site.
That's how many pages total were viewed in a month as opposed to how many unique visitors you got.
Oh, I see.
So we might get between 4 and 6 million unique visitors, and we might get between 50 and 70 million page views a month.
Oh, there's something to aspire to, Patrick.
Hold on. Minus the exaggeration. That's still a lot.
I don't make up the numbers, although I recently...
You're told like the to. Numbers.
I'm told, absolutely.
I'll be honest with you, we do the same, like only Heather and I know any of the official numbers.
Really?
Yeah, so we're like a billion. That's what everyone's like. There were a billion people. I don't know if that was unique hits or just...
What does that mean
who's
exactly?
Who's check on it anyway, right?
Yeah, right.
How?
Right.
And who cares?
I don't know. There's some way. No, there's a mechanism for measuring that.
Well, the thing about it is that ultimately, who cares is that advertisers will pay a certain price based on how many people eyeballs are looking at. So
you are heavily advertised, I saw.
We have been somewhat lucky recently, and we look for sponsors. I really don't know the difference between advertisers and sponsors sometimes. But when we roll out new features like our cell phone, our iPhone application, which is free, and you can access all 25,000 tested recipes, you know, we had to have someone in there to help us sponsor it, I guess, to help us pay for it. And that, increasingly, that is something that we're thinking about, just knowing that someone is in for this great feature. So that's part of my job is deciding, well, what do we just need flat out and have needed for a while versus what is something that might be sponsorable?
Right. Right.
It's a reality.
Interesting.
Reality
well, we're going through that. I mean, basically now we're going through the Heritage Foods' immediate network. But eventually, you know, we know that if we're going to attract big sponsors, we have to literally prove how many people came to their site via ours. I mean, accountability sucks, I'm telling you.
It's so much easier to just say a billion.
Yeah.
And believe it.
I'm like, it's exactly that. I had to log on 3 times at midnight just to get to the number.
Yeah, that's right. Me too.
But and now tell us, haven't wine pairings been just an added feature to your site? I mean, that's a new thing, right?
You are so kind to mention that. Absolutely. It's one of my proudest achievements because I come to Epicurious with a strong background in covering beer, wine, and spirits, and not everyone there does. You know, there are people who have been chefs or have gone to culinary school. There are lifelong journalists. There are some people who are big on the healthy beat or big on book publishing and know every book that's coming out that's food related. And I'm the guy who talks to people about beer, wine, and spirits. And one of the things that our readers constantly discussed when they would send us email or leave comments in our forums and our blogs on the recipes was we'd like to see more pictures of food. We'd like to see nutritional information, which both things we've added a lot to.
Right.
And then finally, we'd like to see wine pairings in some capacity. And it was always, we did the most we could, which we would have articles about wine pairing. We'd get big names to write about wine pairings, Kevin Zerali or you know, almost anyone you can think of. We had Jancis Robinson and all these people, Andrea Emmer Robinson. And finally, we partnered with a company called Snooth about 6 months ago. And Snooth is this just fantastically dynamic and fast-moving organization. Fast-moving meaning that they seem to be able to get things done in an attractive and meaningful way quickly without a lot of headaches.
Kind of like the staff at Roberta's.
Yeah, and Heritage. I mean, the way we started, tactical over strategic, even though there's a strategy, you know, in mind.
And between the two of us, we it took forever, but we now have it so that if you go to our recipe database, which is the tested part of the recipes, not members can upload their own recipes, but those aren't tested. So we make that distinction so that when people mm-hmm. come to Epicurious, they know that they're going to get recipes that have been tested, not just thrown up there, you know, because we thought it should be, and also ranked and rated and reviewed so that you can conceivably either see the newest recipes or the highest ranked ones. But the majority of them will now have wine pairings. The ones that won't are either food-friendly, kid-friendly dishes, which we didn't think was appropriate to have booze with, and breakfast, which, you know, if you really need, you know, to decide what cocktail to have with scrambled eggs, then, you know, go elsewhere.
You're on your own.
right. Or just to have a beer. It always works. But the idea is that also all the wine that we have has a photo. It's all nationally available, and it most of it is under $20 a bottle, which we thought was very important, so that we weren't going to be trying to get people to, or suggesting that you buy, you know, a $300 bottle of something. Yeah. And someday we will migrate to being able to have beer pairings as well, but right now it's sort of almost beta. We just launched this about a week
ago. Would you say that beer pairings are starting to be the new wave? Like, there's a restaurant here in Brooklyn called Beer Table, and I know that that's what they do. Their whole menu is paired to their beer, their food menu is paired to their beer menu.
I
see that as a big trend that's developing, don't you?
It definitely is, and many people think that beer is at least as food-friendly as wine is.
Yeah.
Garrett Oliver over at Brooklyn Breweries is a huge advocate of this.
The beer goes better. It doesn't, because with wine, you're like, oh, this cuts against, you know, whereas the beer goes with.
Particularly if you're talking about foods that have, well, a lot of Asian foods go particularly well with beer.
Yes, they do.
And just heavy, rich foods. The carbonation helps, but also you have a lot more to play with in some ways with beer because you have hops and different kinds of barley. And with wine, you have the grapes, and you just hope that you can ferment and distill them properly.
Right. I have a personal opinion, beer making is really a recipe.
Though, I think that the beer guys should not, I mean, this is just completely personal, play the same tasting format game that wine does.
I mean, like a shy
beer
wine
is good for the meal. I don't like having seven beers. You know, I don't think they should be held accountable to try to give you seven beers. The whole concept of a beer is that you get a six pack of one thing and that you pound it down and that you can get it. You know, but I've always felt bad for them when they're like, and for your 11th beer, you know, and you're like, I don't know.
I guess the problem with that is that if you have multi-courses and you just say, ah, this beer goes with everything, then there's a little bit of a kind of boy cried wolf in that.
But it's also all the more challenging. Or maybe you could do two, you know, but try to get this whole meal contained by a beer that could maybe change after it ages or something.
I think you're totally right. In the same way that when people ask me for wine pairing advice, I mean, fundamentally speaking, the easiest thing is get a bottle of red and get a bottle of white.
Yeah.
And within that, you can get very esoteric. But if you get a bottle of each, you're going to cover your bases regardless of what the dish is, unless you're having, you know, either the lightest seafood and salad dishes that can't hold up to a red wine,
right.
Or you're getting something that's so thick and heavy that any white wine's going to be blown away. But I actually think you could do the same thing with beer.
Those
certainly.
Beer things, all those million tastings are like the haute couture of the beer world. Like, no one does it. I mean, other than, like, as a market table, you know, I mean, I'm sure they've figured it out.
There are beer sommeliers in New York City as well. There's one on the Upper East Side. And I'm just not remembering the name of the restaurant, but he was the first beer sommelier who will come over and consult with you about his massive beer list. And I totally trust him. I think that the flavor profiles are completely diverse, and there's no way that I can possibly drink all these great beers that are sourced sometimes locally, but oftentimes much more international.
That'd be really interesting to make a movie with one of these young comedians, like being a beer sommelier for fraternities or something. He's like, so it's hazing day again, huh? For you, a Belgian lambic.
That's right. Raspberry flavored for girls.
I just tasted a watermelon beer recently.
Really?
I didn't really like it, but it just goes to show you what people are doing. You know, I've heard of blueberry, and I've heard of fruitiness, of course, in beers, but watermelon was taking it to a brand new realm. I've heard of also wine coolers, but this almost was like the fruity beer cooler.
Yeah, now, I don't like that idea.
That reminds me, one thing I would agree with Pollen about, like, I don't think people need to be, you know, feeling guilty that they don't cook. Like you said, it could be a time thing.
Oh, I do.
No, I know. Well, but then I will say this. I do think every person needs to be involved with something, some process. So you could be pickling something, you could be curing a garden, you could be home brewer, you know, which is a big trend. Like, I think everyone should be connected to some making, but it doesn't have to be in the form of, you know, a
three
pasta
squares
dish
a day.
4 days a night, you know,
yeah,
four
right.
nights a week.
No, but I mean, one way to skin that cat, actually, and something that I do during the regular, my regular cat. Yeah, mouse tureen. Another one of my favorites. No, is to designate one afternoon a week where you just spend time in the kitchen. I mean, you think about it, it's something, and you make a couple of dishes and they tide you over for the rest of the week. You've solved your dinner problem when you get home late from work. You're feeding your kids in a nice way. I mean, I'm a parent. I don't want my daughter eating takeout food every night. I mean, it's, even if it's good takeout food, I still don't want that to happen.
Well, also, I think in the older days, in the 70s and 80s, or 60s, 70s, 80s, like even a thing like SpaghettiOs was actually more nutritious. The calories weren't as empty. I think they took shortcuts since, you know, because in the, I think in the 70s, you got SpaghettiOs. It wasn't considered so bad. No, I know. Well, that I think they they've become emptier, you know, so the next best option
is a lot of sugar. Yeah. A lot of high fructose corn syrup.
Even back in the day? Like, is Captain Crunch?
Yeah, it was a very sugary. It was a very sugary preparation even back then, because that's what kids like. They like sweet, salty.
Not Chef Boyardee.
Yeah. Even the chef.
I ate a lot of those things growing up, too. And I had a mother who was not a particularly interested in cooking, and lots of shortcuts and lots of frozen food. And I don't know what it would have taken to get her to be more of a... She had apparently cooked for my father when they were courting, but that dropped off. So there was the sense that she knew that she could, and when needed, she would do it, and she was pretty good. And I really don't know if it's better access or easier access to grocery shopping with, you know, we now have online shopping. We have places like that'll deliver to your
Like
your
Fresh Direct, Fresh Direct or something like that.
What I was thinking of. I just don't know what it would take to get people to do more of that. I don't think that any kind of imperative is going to do it. I don't think that saying like people should, But I think that one of the things that Epicurious does that makes it a little easier, at least, is that we have recommendations that sometimes will help you go through the week, so that if you buy a chicken, it's not like that's just that night's dinner. There's also leftovers and all kinds of ideas so that you can make use of it. So it's good for the people who are feeling the recession, who want to make an ingredient stretch, but it also means that you can cook something that's going to last for 2 or 3 days or more. Right. And I think that might help people when they realize, well, I'll put a little bit of effort in one night, but at least for the next 3 or 4 nights, I don't have to do anything.
Nah, that's kind of the just deal. Me personally, same thing 3 nights in a row. Like, I mean, that's just, I completely agree with what you're saying. I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, I would almost argue fast food, but done well, like a slow fast food, you know, if that is it. Sure. Indeed.
Well, is there another fast food that makes reasonably good tasting food with using responsible ingredients?
No, I'm
not aware of anyone else doing it.
You know, like Chipotle, but I think it could be a little pizza place. If they increase the law of number of truck stands that could exist, you know, like the mud truck equivalent of, you know, there could be in every neighborhood. I mean, the Sabarek guy was essentially that, you know, that could be sustainable too. And think about, they could be organizing a landing area for all the ground beef of all the producers in New England, you know, and turning it into some grind to every park. You know, I think that's now within range. It's just someone has to do it.
Well, I think it's also, I think fundamentally the question is going to be, will people pay a little bit more? How much more will it be, and will they pay it?
I mean, I think yes. I mean, a pizza here costs $7, I think, the margarita. I mean, it can be done. Because of local minus the food miles, and you know, it depends how much money someone's trying to make. If they're trying to get rich like McDonald's, no. You know, if they're trying to pay for 3 people to live, I think it could exist. There could be thousands of people just in Brooklyn like that.
But. Well, before we wrap it up with you, James, let's talk a little bit about your Green Market initiative and the things that Epicurious is doing with Green Market and Green Market recipes and so forth.
You know, Epicurious is very involved with its community, whether that's online or in person. Every year we have basically this thing called Wine, Dine, Donate, which is a separate event that takes place where we host dinners in different cities, celebrity kind of chefs, and people pay money to go to the dinner to meet the chefs, and a portion of that goes to charities like America's Second Harvest, oftentimes feeding people who are homeless or hungry. And then we also encourage people to have their own Wine, Dine, Donate programs at home, and perhaps to raise money at home, even with you know, a party where you might have
nice
everyone
idea.
Contribute $10 or $20 and donate that money to a cause. This summer, starting in Phoenix last week, going through the end of the summer, we're doing something that's a Green Market promotion where we want to meet the people who are at the Green Markets. We want to meet the farmers. We want to meet the cooks. We want to meet the Epicurious fans. And so Tanya Steele, our editor-in-chief, is going to be going to San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and going to some of the prominent green markets there. They're all linked to on a page in Epicurious, which is in our farm to table section, which is part of our seasonal cooking extravaganza. And we'll be giving away eco-friendly tote bags and lots of recipes, but the idea is really that we'll have a stand and we'll be meeting people there and I guess, to some degree, fostering the sense of green markets and community and the use of seasonal and local ingredients.
So encouraging people in those cities to go out to their green market, not only to meet you, but also to meet the people who are producing the food locally
for
them.
Who are going to give them the tools to carry out Epicurious's recipes.
Hopefully, if you like Epicurious, maybe you don't go to your green market a lot. Now you know where it is, and if you come visit us, you'll get a tote bag to carry your groceries home in, and you'll be aware of what recipes you can use with these ingredients that you just bought.
Right, absolutely. Well, yeah. I think that's, I mean, to go back to that question of like, how are we going to get people back into the kitchen? There's no imperative. But one of the things that I certainly have noticed is that there are relatively few home economic programs or cooking programs, vocational programs in schools nowadays. So when kids come out of school, lots of times they don't really even know how to make a pot of spaghetti for themselves. I mean, quite literally.
Well, that's wrong. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And I had this really interesting conversation. I was up in Harlem at the train station last week, and I was reading My Life in France, you know, the one half of the new movie. And this woman sat
Julia
next
Child
to me.
Julia Child author?
Yeah, Julia Child and her nephew. And this woman was sitting next to me, and she said, oh, is that the book that the movie is based on? And I said, well, part of it. And then she proceeded to tell me that she lived in the Bronx. She was a single parent. She took her kid. When her daughter arrived at high school age, she decided that the ghetto school was not going to be okay for her kid. She moved to New Rochelle, where they had a vocational cooking aspect in their high school, and the girl started baking, and she's become a mad baker and now has a whole career. Mine's like, this is a kid who was completely adrift and had no sort of particular interest in school.
Rudderless.
Yeah, exactly. A rudderless child who wasn't interested in school, didn't really see herself as college material, but knew she kind of had to go through the motions, and suddenly she was handed a profession.
And here you are supporting her demise through promoting home cooking.
I know. Well, maybe she'll be teaching in the next vocational program.
Well, this has been a fascinating interview. I hope, James, that you come back, because the whole thing about tagging is, you know, it's like, size of the words, how much something is talked about over time. And because we build ourselves as a search engine, certainly for this show and for other shows, we hope you come back to the network.
I would love to. This is a fascinating setup you have here, and a terrific conversational threads that just go all over the place, and you don't know what's going to happen. And
tangents all the time.
Yes, digressions. That's the best part of talking to people, of course. And I can talk about anything, but I think there's this commonality of, you know, even tags as a.
Yeah.
I think people who follow food and go to websites have to know about tags these days. Like it's a concept within your culinary expertise, in a way, to know that I'm interested in, you know, grilling and barbecuing as opposed to baking or whatever it may be. Or,
right.
Just what do you think of the pizza? Do you think it's a great pizza, or how do you rank it?
I think it was a delicious pizza. I didn't have time to really think about it. The radishes scared me when I saw them there, just because I don't have radish on my pizza, but I like parsley. And I do like tomato sauce on my pizza as well. I think you were talking about the tomato sauce ratio. And so I liked it. I think that I really like the crust. I like how thin it is. And it looks very green and produce-y, and I like that too.
And refreshing.
Can we get a couple of headlines just about sandwiches? Like, just tell us some of the names of the articles, or like some of the issues you tackled. Like, was it more the history of it, or is there a city that specializes in it?
These were the wackiest. There were trucks in one of the universities in upstate New York. I forget if it was Rochester or somewhere else, where you would. There was a sandwich called the Daryl, and this was a guy who got drunk many nights and would go up to the sandwich trucks. I think they were called grease trucks, actually. Huh. And he eventually wanted them to make him a sandwich that had everything that he could possibly order, almost, which was like French fries as well as, you know, every side dish. And they just piled it all on a sandwich and called it the Daryl. And that was the number one sandwich that we covered.
Wow.
And, you know,
do they have the Daryl? I hope they're listening to us at the Roberta's Kitchen.
Yeah, that's right. Let's put the Daryl on the menu. Actually, I've noticed that sandwich menus for lunch or dinner seem to be making a huge comeback on restaurant menus.
Well, hamburgers right now are huge, and that's on lunch and dinner, and it's inexpensive, and everyone's got either their fancy hamburger or their classic hamburger.
Pat LaFrieda, our distributor, you know, our partner here in New York, is a big part of that whole revolution.
And a hamburger is technically a sandwich, is what I was going to say, and that it's, you know, two pieces of bread and something in between. That's thunder in the background. Not a sound effect.
That's not the studio collapsing upon ourselves.
That's God voicing his disdain,
disapproval
for,
of the hamburger?
For something.
That's so un-American of him.
Well, that is, it's been awesome. So thanks for being on.
Yeah, the next time you come, James, we'll have to talk about sandwiches some more, because I think the sandwich phenomenon is kind of an interesting one to explore, because it's really kind of a very American style of eating and goes back a long, long way in our culinary history here.
Yes, we have regional sandwiches.
More than any other country,
there's signature dishes in each city. There's the, you know, the muffalata, which you talked about before,
right,
in New Orleans.
The Philly cheesesteak.
Philly cheesesteak, you know, Katz's pastrami and rye. I mean, every town almost has its classic. Right. There are grinders and hoagies and...
Oh yeah, grinders. That's a very Rhode Island thing to call it a grinder.
I had some in Connecticut.
So. Uh huh.
Maybe because we had the vast expanses, maybe the hamburger being a sandwich, maybe that was the whole beginning of it, because we had so much beef here. Like, that was, once they invented barbed wire and could like herd beef and keep beef in an area throughout the West, like, there's just so much friggin' ground beef around that,
well,
it
what
just
else?
Started,
I mean,
a sandwich idea.
Patrick, you know that from being a meat distributor. I mean, what do you do with, you know...
We don't even buy the whole cows. We do 150 pigs a week, and then we buy just cases of cow because we can't sell 1,000
pounds. Right, because you can't just sell... I mean, there's a lot more to the cow than the short loin.
It's
and,
like,
you know, where all the great steaks come from. I mean, most of the rest of the cow gets ground up into ground meat. And, well, anyway, we could go on and on
about
this.
Could go on.
But, yeah.
God, I'm about to start fuming that the cow...
I learned a new thing.
Like,
I will tell you one thing that I learned from George Faison about making hamburgers, which I had never known, which is when you put your burger on the grill or in the skillet, you make a little depression with your thumb.
The
Did
dimple.
You know this already?
Yes.
I didn't know about the dimple. And the reason that you make the dimple is when you flip the burger doesn't then rise up and have a convex surface. Mm. Because you never want to press your burger down with a spatula. You always want it, because that squeezes all the juices out.
I sense a new gadget for Heritage Foods, the impressor.
Maybe you could put your logo on that as well, so every burger has your logo.
You'd have a little ceramic thumb, that's right. Anyway, so your burger cooks up nice and flat.
All right, well, we are going to have James on again, James Oliver Curry from Epicurious.com. Check out their new wine pairing feature. It's very exciting.
And their green market feature.
Yeah, and all those fabulous events. Yeah. So, and James, you'll be at those events, right?
I will not, but our editor-in-chief, Tanya Steele.
She's very glamorous, too.
Really the face of Epicurious.
Yes.
And what a face.
You're more the
Super
face
glam.
For radio.
Yes, I'm the face for radio, absolutely. And rightfully so.
All right. Well, we will be back for
so
a brief
much,
conclusion.
James. This is great.
On the main course, brought to you by White Oak Pastures. So do you have a food of the week or anything like that?
Me, right now?
Yeah, like, what is the food of next week
well,
for Heritage Radio Network? Which food are we getting behind?
I'm going to get behind some pork this week, because I'm like all wound up about Mexican cooking again right now. I don't know why, but I'm really into it. So
I like fennel cookies.
I like fennel. I like fennel in any form. I like it crispy. I like it cooked. I like it in seeds and cooking and Indian food. Indian food uses a lot of fennel, by the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you hear about that guy? I can't believe we didn't cover this, about the guy that was arrested for eating the bald eagle. Did you hear about that?
Oh, no. Why didn't you send me that?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a very, very funny story.
How was it?
Well, I mean, apparently...
Did it taste like chicken?
No, he actually had an answer. Like, it apparently had been swooping down, like, to kill its family or, you know, kill his dog or something.
Right.
Because it was sick. And so he picked up a rock and threw it and hit it in the head. And then it died. So, by good luck, bad luck, whatever, it was it killed it. So, to honor it, he ate it. And the judge was, you know, basically let him go. But right as he was walking out of the courtroom, he was like, you know, what did it taste like? And the guy's like, partway between a Komodo dragon and a spotted owl. And then they knew that
this guy was going down the list.
Well, this has been a great show. Now, are you, you're at a studio next week, right? So we're going to be calling you in.
Yeah,
for...
and I also, I interviewed, as I said, Perry Rosso from Matunic, and I hope to be bringing some regular segments from Rhode Island, you know, sending, taping them on my nifty little voice recorder. And nice. Yeah, we'll be making some little segments out of that. And yeah, I hope we'll do a telephone segment. I'll be up in my vacation land, which is Wakefield, Rhode Island, and taking in the local food scene. There's a lot going on up there, so I'm really hoping to make tons of connections while I'm there this week, this month, and you know, visit with people who are producing cheese in my practically my hometown, with Perry, with other oystermen, with other fishermen. Lots of aquaculture. There's a lot of beef growing there. There's my guy who grows corn has suddenly branched out into beef also. So we have a whole conversation to have with him. There's a lot going on.
All right. So we are going to be back next week. And our theme, let's plan it like Sunday morning, the morning of the show.
Yeah, let's do that.
Awesome.
That always sounds good. I'm Katie Kiefer. You're
Patrick Martins.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network.
Brought to you by White Oak Pastures in Georgia. We'll be right back.